Hello, everyone. I'm Dominique.
And I'm Christina, and we are the Connected in Glass podcast.
Every week, we will feature interviews with glass artists who speak to their creative processes and overcoming challenges.
These conversations are real and raw. We hope that by sharing these stories, you're able to find some connection and know that you're not alone.
We just wanted to take a moment to thank you for listening to our podcast. We're super passionate about this project and work for hours every week to bring you this content. So if you'd like to help support us, please consider becoming a patron at patreon.com/connectedinglass. Also, please consider joining our Facebook group, Connected in Glass Community, where we continue the conversations from these episodes. We'd love to hear from you.
This episode of Connected in Glass is sponsored by DiddyClips. DiddyClips has changed the way we film our glassblowing videos, and we're proud to be working with them.
Today, we're interviewing Megan Stelgis. Megan is a glass artist based in Arlington, Washington, who's been working with glass since 2003.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So first, we want to know all about you. Maybe skip the glass part of your life for a moment. Tell us about where you live, what you do for fun, and then work us into the story of how you started working with glass.
Okay. I live in Arlington, Washington now, and I grew up in Kansas, but I moved out to the Pacific Northwest to work in glass. And I lived in Seattle and Tacoma. And then my friends, Jimmy and Nicole Andreg, wanted to start a community shop. And in Arlington, we live on 20 acres. My husband Connor and I have our own two that we have a little house on, and there's a barn in between. And then Jimmy and Nicole are our neighbors, but we can't see their. So that's where I live. And it's a really big part of my life and studio practice and all those things. So it's all kind of circled back into one.
And what do you do for fun that's not glass?
I think aside from glass, my world revolves a lot around my dog and our cat. And right now I'm babysitting one of my good friend's dogs, Ido, who is my dog's best friend. So it's like mostly all dog all the time around here. But I'm really big into spending time with people I love.
Okay, so now tell us how you started working with glass.
There was a glassblower in my hometown, and my mom actually was like, you should go down there and check it out. And she's always been a great advocate for me and the arts. And so I went down there, and he had me hang out a little bit and then apprentice. And that lasted for just a couple months. And then 9/11 happened, and so the shop closed. But I really had already fallen in love with the material, so I decided to go to college for glass after blowing glass for like 2 months at 16 or something, which is a little crazy, but also when you know, you know. And then I went to college at Emporia State, and that's where I really started my glass education.
So you just did an apprenticeship and you liked it so much and you just knew and you just did it.
Yep.
That's pretty impressive.
It feels like foolhardy, but I don't know. It just felt right.
So then after college, you moved out to the area you live in now to pursue glass jobs. Is that how it worked?
Yeah. My good friend and mentor, Karen Willenbrink Johnson, came and did some she was a demonstrating artist for the week. And I skipped all my other classes and helped her. And then I think I was a sophomore and she asked me if I would ever want to come out and help her. And of course I said yes. So anytime I had a break from school, I would go and help Karen and Jason in the hot shop. And at that time they were working out of Pilchuck Glass School in the off season. And so I did that until I graduated. When I graduated, she invited me to come work for her. So that I just moved straight out to Pilchuck. And I lived at Pilchuck for the whole winter that first year. And then I eventually got my own place.
And can you describe your style of glass, like your creative style, just for the people that haven't had a chance to look at your work yet?
Yeah, I kind of float in between a few different, well, I work in neon and hot sculpted glass. So my neon style is like a little bit more traditional classic bending, you know, using like neon and argon mercury. And I do a lot of words or a lot of fruit based imagery. And then my hot shop style is leaning a little bit more towards trompe l'oeil. I really like the challenge of trying to match colors and textures and form. So I try and mimic oftentimes food as close to the natural world as possible while still employing a lot of bright colors and fun themes.
And can you tell us a little bit about your creative process, maybe how you get your ideas and the process in which you go from idea to glass?
Sure. I feel like I should start at the way back and talk about a little bit of college and like the root, I feel like, of my, where my art started, I guess. So when I was in college, I was, you know, trying to find my voice, and I was making a bunch of just things that every college student's ever made, you know. And then I started making some really overtly sexual artwork, and there were like, people would go into the studio and cover it up. And like, people were like shutting down so fast before they would even interact with my work. And so I had this sort of moment of pause where I was like, okay, it's important to me that my artwork is consumable for everybody. So how do I reach this audience that's shutting down about something that I think is really important? So in that moment, I sort of decided to use humor and also objects that everybody already has a narrative with. So I use a lot of food, and everybody already has a relationship with fruits and vegetables. And it can be, you know, I could just be making a fruit plate, you know, or it could have a lot of sexual innuendo. And it really leaves that line of comfortability up to the viewer and just allows people to kind of take their time and move into the work and not be so afraid of having conversations about what I like to make my artwork about. So that being said, most of my work made to sort of generate a conversation about sex or sexuality in some capacity. And the reason for that is to start conversations around things like consent or sexual health, which I feel like are the root of a lot of problems in our society and just will lead people to living a better life, the more comfortable we can be around conversations for those. So that being the goal, it was a very roundabout way of saying, so a lot of the work, my creative process is kind of always tying back to that and looking to how I can kind of A, be like a little bit cheeky or funny, and then, you know, tie in my artwork to my message. And a lot of times I just get inspiration at the grocery store or like, you know, a funny conversation in the hot shop. It's pretty average. And now that it's inspiring, I feel like where my inspiration actually comes from, it's so everyday. But I think that's sort of what's important about my work to me, is that it is something that is everyday or everybody already has an interaction with. So that's what makes it relatable.
And so you get your inspiration, and then do you kind of write it out or draw it out? Or are you one of those people that can just visualize where you want to go in your head so you can just take it right to the studio, or a little bit of everything?
A little bit of both. I usually, to be honest, get my ideas when I'm driving in the car, which is like maybe not super safe because then I start focusing too much on that. But so I get my idea and then I mull over for a really, really long time. And then once I sort of have that complete idea in my head, then I get to pen and paper, and I am not as good at the sketchbook as I would like to be. I wish that I drew a little bit more, because I feel like when I do sit down and sketch, ideas come more readily. But generally I sit down and after having an idea, really fully forming it in my head, and then I'll sort of start to map it out. And if it's in neon, I've just recently started using the computer, which is like a big step for me. I'm not good with technology. So I'll draw out my pattern, and that has to be sort of an exact map of what it's going to be. And then in the hot shop, if it's a sculptural object, I'll print out a lot of pictures or go to the grocery store and buy reference and, you know, stage things up. And that way I can really start to observe the textures and things like that. And then I'll start to move forward. So it's kind of a slow process before I start a piece.
And with that like slow process, how do you even like think about pricing your work like that?
So pricing is so difficult because people ask me sometimes, they're like, well, how long did that take you? And I'm like, well, that thing might have been 15 minutes, but it's like 15 minutes in 20 years, you know, because I had this idea, but I've had to think all these million other thoughts before I could get to this space or have all this experience. So I guess now my pricing has sort of evolved from when I was young and had work that was like grossly underpriced and realizing that I was really losing money. And it's evolved into a place where now after selling for a little while, I definitely do the breakdown of, you know, how much I have invested in the work. And then sort of now kind of what fair market value is, I guess, whatever that means, but it's all up in the air. There's not, I just don't feel like there, people say that there's a equation for it, but I don't know. It's messy. Pricing is really messy.
And so the work that you do is so personal and you've got such a deep message beyond, like beneath everything that you make. How do you not let other people's judgments of what your message is affect how you continue making your work?
You know, to be honest, I am sort of oblivious in some ways because when I make work, it's always with people that I really love. And so when I'm in the hot shop or my neon community, I've made a really big point to have this beautiful community around me, right? So oftentimes I think this is a really good thing for my practice is like, I always create an environment in a very supportive environment. So then it's already done before I realize that there's going to be, you know, criticism or somebody having something bad to say about it. Or so one of my professors in college told me this thing and I really have taken it to heart. And he said, as you're making, like you can't pass judgment on your work while it's in your hands. So like when I'm actually sculpting or when I'm formulating an idea, I like pretend that I am like amazing and I'm the best ever. And there's like, I'm infallible. And then once the work is done or you end, you know, the day in the studio, you can take a step back and say like, all right, that's a little sloppy. I need to tighten this up here. Or, you know, maybe this could be like reshaped or, you know, I should remake that part. But as I'm making, I don't really even like give space to criticism, I guess. And that's part of the mulling over the work so much before I start a piece. But I don't know. I just kind of am oblivious for the most part. I've had some criticism and oftentimes it comes from a place of, it's just their own shit, I guess. You know, it's somebody who has different viewpoints than I, they're never going to appreciate me as a person or my views or my work. And it's just not even worth going down a road with them, I guess, you know? So I think just creating in a space of love and support.
That's a good space to be in. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Good, you said that you and your husband work together in the hot shop. What's that like?
You know, sometimes good, sometimes bad. I am really guilty of being open for ideas from friends. And then my husband will say something. I'm like, no, don't even try and give me some suggestions. So, you know, I could be a bit more receptive sometimes. And, you know, he could work a little harder for me sometimes. But for the most part, he's really supportive and really kind. He's also an excellent cold worker, which I really lean on because I am terrible. And he like always helps me glue my pieces together. And it can be a lot. It can be a lot to work with your partner and be around them all the time. We both work in glass, but often have different jobs. So now when we do get to work together, it's really fun generally because we used to do like 9 to 5 all the jobs together, but now it's really fun. And it's kind of like, you know, getting to hang out with a friend at work it's a positive thing.
Do you think that you've had a different experience as a woman in glass than you would if you were a man? Or do you think that because you and your husband are in the same career path that you notice people treat him a little bit differently than you? Or do you feel like it's been rather equal?
I do think people treat men and women in general differently, but also especially in glass. I have a lot of experiences where if there's a female and a male in a room, that people will expect that the man can do something and then ask if a woman can do something or be surprised that she can. And sometimes in that space, you know, I'll be in a hot shop and I'll have like taught the male that's in there that's younger than me. And I'll have like, he's been one of my students. And people will be like, oh, obviously, because he has a penis, he can do that. And then ask me, or, you know, and it, sometimes I get really frustrated with that. And again, it's back to that sort of, I've really made a point to keep myself in circles that are really supportive. And, you know, I work with people that are supportive of me and supportive of all people. I can't let myself be in environments where, because that happens so much. It happens so much in glass that there's ego involved, or there's like praise for lifting a big thing, or there's just like the root of the way that we work in glass is like the maestro, right? There's like the dude king and everybody should worship him. And that's really problematic, right? So I have made a point to surround myself with people who have sort of evolved past that. But also when it does happen, I just try and be clear. It's such a hard thing to navigate, because if you're too aggressive, then all of a sudden you're this angry woman, and it's terrible to navigate it. But people do treat men and women very differently in the hot shop. And I think that that's evolving. Just, you know, it'll take time, which is a pain in the ass, but I'm really grateful. My husband was raised by a single mom, and he has such an amazing perspective on life. And he's like always had these like female mentors. And so he is like so girl power, and my studio mates are that same way. So I come home to that, and that's just part of my life.
Okay. So being a woman and making the majority of your work is about sex positivity and consent. And do you ever experience where like people take your work and sexualize you?
A little bit. And the thing that happens most often is like a middle-aged man comes up to me and is like, Megan, did you know your work is phallic? And I'm like, holy shit, revelation. Like, I had no idea. Wow. Sometimes they do. And that's also a big reason why I make the work that I make, because I feel like in the culture that I live in generally, like women aren't supposed to be outwardly sexual. And, you know, maybe like you're supposed to be sexual in private with your partner, but you're never supposed to. Like men are like allowed to be these like playboys or what, I don't know. It's just where women are so supposed to be so quiet about their sexuality. So it's important to me to be a woman that does make work about sex and be, and have a voice, have a feminine sexual voice in the art scene. But yeah, people do sometimes sexualize me, and I would like to say that I always stand up for myself and do a good job of navigating that. Oftentimes I'm better about standing up for others, but what I try and do in that moment is like assert myself in the moment when it's happening and either educate the person who is doing that and, you know, separate myself from my work, or, you know, sometimes it happens in groups. If there's like a tour or something, somebody will make a snide comment and I just sort of try and redirect the conversation. It's difficult waters to navigate, because also you're worried about your own personal safety, right? Like, is this person just saying that because they think it's funny, or like, are they like a bit of a predator, or like, how is this going to end? Is it going to end well? Yeah. And so with my own safety in mind, I just try and be as assertive with my own boundaries and what makes me feel respected in the moment. And if that doesn't feel safe or possible, I try and redirect.
Do you ever feel that you're stuck? Like, do you ever find that you don't have creative ideas, or that you don't feel like working or making? Do you ever like suffer from depression or anxiety that like kind of blocks you in that way?
Yes, all the above. Yeah, I'm a huge procrastinator, and I live in the Pacific Northwest. So I think like 11 out of every 10 people here suffer from depression. So, you know, I think I was just talking to a good friend of mine who's a college professor. And I think that everybody who's an artist just like automatically go get a therapist, like get one. You need one. The art world is really difficult for so many reasons. You just need one. Go get one. But also it's like incredibly personal. It's incredibly challenging. You're always like, your work is always like on display for other people. There's just not a way that you're not going to feel vulnerable. I struggle a lot with procrastination and worrying about, is this next piece going to be as good as the last one? Can I pull it off? Is it going to work out? Have I peaked? So my biggest struggle is procrastination. And to procrastinate, I clean the house, which is like, you know, feels like you're doing something, but when I get really stuck, I think the best thing that I do for myself is like wake up in the morning and I make a play-by-play list. So like wake up, let's lie and say wake up at 7 o'clock. I always wake up later than that. 7 o'clock, you're going to wake up. You're going to have breakfast and coffee from 7 to 7:30. Then at 7:30, you're going to feed the dog. Then, you know, and so I do this like really intense breakdown play-by-play. And then that way I have something to be accountable for. And I'm like, oh shit, I'm already running late. I got to get down to the studio because at this time. And then it also gives me, and I schedule in breaks, but it also gives me a break from the studio too, because sometimes I feel like when you're hard pressed to be making something or you have a deadline coming up, it feels like you have to go down there and you have to do it all in one go. And you need to like be manic and be down there for 17 hours. Otherwise you're not a hard worker. And the truth is there's like the point of limited return, right? Where you're like, I'm just breaking shit and this isn't good for me. It's not good for my work. It's not fun anymore. So that's the best strategy I found to get myself in and making on those days that I don't really want to.
I love lists. So you got me right there.
Nice.
I feel like cleaning is such a good like procrastination activity because it literally never ends. So you just constantly have excuses to just keep cleaning. I'm totally guilty. So when you said that, I'm like, yes.
I posted a picture of, I was like in my studio procrastinating and organizing this tie wire for neon. It was very stupid anyway, but I was like, this is what I'm doing. So I'm going to share it with the world. And I got so much feedback from other artists' friends about procrastinating. And it was so funny to me because I was like, we are in this together. It just was such a, like a unifying thing. It made me laugh so hard. Cause I was like, you know, I'll post pictures of your work, whatever. People say, oh, that's great. Yeah. Yeah. But picture of procrastination and everybody's like, I totally get this in a very deep, deep way.
So funny. Okay. So in my mind, working neon and working in the hot shop are completely different, mostly because you got to work as a team in the hot shop. And in the neon studio, you're working really independently. Can you tell us a little bit about that and maybe the different mindsets that it takes to work with the two different mediums?
Totally. I love that about Glass and Neon, that they're so different. And I am really, really, really extroverted until I'm not. And then I'm like, I need my space. I don't want to talk to anybody. I need quiet. And so finding Neon has been really good for my art practice because it balances me out a little bit. And I, you know, there's the classic, you know, well, you could make it in ceramics. Why do you make it in glass? It's so expensive. And, you know, and I'm like, well, because I genuinely love it and I love the community and it's fun and it brings me so much enjoyment. And I'm a really physical person. I'm also super ADHD. So having like your left hand and your right hand doing stuff and then having to think about what your partner's going to do, all those things suit me so well as a person. And it's just so fun, but it's also really exhausting for me because it is all those things. Right. And so I call neon's like my glass yoga. So like, sometimes you don't want to do it. Let's be real. It's like not always the most fun to slow down and be really quiet, but it's really important to my practice and also important to me as a person because it takes a lot of extreme focus and I like put on quiet music. I love it. It also has like really hard parameters. Like you have to follow the map. The bends have to be right. Otherwise it's going to break, which is really different than the hot shop. You know, you're like, oh, well, I made a thing and it looks kind of like a thing good enough for today or whatever. We can move forward. So I think the rules and the boundaries of neon are good for me too, because then it makes me appreciate that flexibility that you have in the hot shop.
If we were to take the different manners that you make income and the different manners that you kind of spread your work out and make it into a pie, can you talk about how that's separated? Like, do you make most of your, like, do you split your income between neon work and doing your hot shop work, or do you do like teaching or a little bit of everything?
I usually have like 27 jobs. I wish I could be, I'm working on being a little bit more organized, but I've started to narrow it down a little bit. So I do make income off selling my work, which is great, but I can't support myself entirely. And then I work for a company called Artful Ashes, and we take cremains and put them into objects that we have orbs and hearts and starfish. And then, so it's a really beautiful thing because you're making something that like brings people genuine joy. And I feel like there's a lot of hot shop jobs that you're like, well, I'm making a bunch of cups today and I don't know where they're going or I don't care, but it's nice because it has, you know, it has a good and powerful impact on the people receiving it. So I really enjoy that job. And then I teach a lot. COVID has really kind of stopped that, but I used to teach in the Museum of Glass for a program called Hot Shop Heroes. And I used to teach in Tacoma also for a program called Arts Connect. And I'm teaching at Pilchuck maybe next summer. We'll see how things go. I work at a neon shop. I love the neon shop I work for, Noble Neon. It's a mom and pop neon shop. And they're really great about me being an artist and being flaky about my schedule and needing time off this week, but then needing work next week, the week after, whatever. So right now it's mostly the neon shop, Artful Ashes, and my studio practice, but I also have a sewing job and some other production glass jobs that I do here and there. But it's a part of it is my, because I just am not a structured person and I need 80 jobs so that I still like each job. Because if I have just one job, then I like get bored and can't do it. But the other part is, you know, with all that work is seems a little bit seasonal and stuff. So stuff comes and goes. So if I have eggs in 80 baskets, then for sure I'll like make rent, you know.
That's pretty cool that you do all that. I mean, it stresses me out a little bit, but I'm just the control freak over here.
It stresses me out too, but I like thrive on a little bit of chaos. I'm trying to like knock that back a little bit, but you know, it's good. It gets me out and I get to see a lot of different people and friends. And I genuinely only work for people I really love. So all the jobs that I go to, I'm around people that are good and close friends of mine. So it's always joyful wherever I'm going, even though it's a bit scattered, wherever I'm going it's always a good place.
So what's your definition of success? Or do you feel like you have already reached that?
So I am like stuck in this existential crisis right now with this exact thing. So I think that success is generally a list of things that people, as we're growing up, it's like this list of things that people tell us we should do. And that's really shitty because it's all other people's opinions. But recently I had this thing happen, which was like great. And it was a goal that I didn't know could happen. I'm part of this show called New Glass Now. And it's going to the Smithsonian, the Renwick Gallery at the Smithsonian, which is like, holy shit, this is like a lifetime goal that I didn't know I had. It happened before I knew it was a goal. I feel so happy about it. Then the next day, I was like, I peaked. I suck. I'm never going to do anything cool again. My life and career is over. And I was like, you know, this like train of bigger and better, and to be successful, you have to like be stressed out and showing all the time, and you have to be maxed out and everything has to be bigger and better and more productive and you have to sell more. I just can't, like, it doesn't work for me and it doesn't make me happy. And so what I think my personal success is if I listen to myself and my body and my family, and, you know, see where I'm genuinely finding happiness versus following all these like make-believe shoulds that somehow I've picked them up along the way. And I'm trying, and those still exist. And I still every day am probably doing something that somebody else told me I should do that I shouldn't be doing. But I'm trying really hard to just be a little bit more true to myself and really find what makes me happy and why I make the work versus following that list of shoulds and what other people's success looks like to them.
Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah.
I just want to know more about like how Karen was your mentor. Can you just tell us a little bit about how she like helped you? One of our questions is always like experiences with mentors and mentees and how they helped you grow. And I just think it's so cool that you met her when you're in college and then you just like moved across and worked for her. Can you just tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So Karen and I are very like, my brain's saying say kindred spirits, but maybe that's cheesy, but we're like loud and we're fun and we like instantly loved each other. And so we have like just a really great bond as friends and people, but through that we worked in the hot shop a lot. And I think Karen, working for Karen is totally responsible for the work that I make now because she's so good at color and color application. And so when I'm being very roundabout about all this. So we met in college and then when I was in college and then I moved out here and that model was to come in and work for her and her husband. And I'd charge the furnace at night and, you know, it was just like kind of a classic glass apprenticeship. And then we just became friends and I continued to work for her for a long time. And, you know, sometimes that was on a big team. Sometimes it was a small day. Ask me more specific questions about it so I can give you a more specific answer.
I don't know. I just think because sometimes people are like, oh, well, I'm more self-taught or whatever. And I just think it's cool that you have somebody that you like mark as like, she's a friend and she's a mentor. And I just think that was a cool part of you.
Yeah, totally. So maybe this will be more an easier route to that. I don't like to be self-taught. I hate that. I like to have the right answer the first time. And I also like to hear it from the person who's the best at it. So Karen is the best at color. And so I just like went right to the source. I don't like to fool around with learning it on my own because the answers exist, especially now in glass. Like everybody's so talented. So, you know, you can usually make like a few phone calls and find somebody who will give you the answer. I don't want to suffer. Glass is hard enough, you know? So I still call Karen and I'm like, Karen, I'm making a watermelon. What color combination is that? And she'll, you know, okay, well, you know, gee, boom. And she still helps me so much. And she came over the other day and, well, I guess this is a long while ago, but I was working on some new forms and she helped me and we just go swimming the other day. But a lot of my technique and the way that I work is based on how she works. And then I think just sort of appreciating glass and the joy it brings to us and our community. And a lot of that comes from being with Karen too.
Yeah. I think it's silly to not ask for help when all the resources are just right there, just to be stubborn to do it on your own.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm such a visual learner. A lot of times if I don't see it being done, I'm also the youngest child. Somebody pointed this out to me and they're like, you must be the baby of the family because you're really good at mimicking physical skills. And I was like, oh, totally. So I just watch my sisters do things and then I can do it. But trying to make that jump on my own, a lot of times I just get overwhelmed. And it can be a simple thing, but I'm like not a YouTuber. I'm not going to read a book about it. I'm going to call a friend. I'm going to watch them do it. And then I will try it.
Cool. All right. So do you have any final words of wisdom?
I don't know about wisdom so much as I don't know. Glass and art is really hard. And I think that being authentically yourself is a lot harder than it seems like it should be. And I think that that is sort of the most important thing about art and life, right? Is like being able to love and support yourself and be true to yourself. And that is like everybody's lifelong journey, right? But the faster you can find that, I feel like the faster and the healthier your passion and your medium will be.
Beautiful.
Perfect.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode of Connected in Glass. Make sure to follow us on Facebook and Instagram for more information on the artists we interview and for updates on the podcast.